Hello, welcome to Wider Window Poetry. I'm Teal Ansari, and before I introduce my guest poet today, I'm going to start by reading a couple of poems by Sandra Lim. Sandra Lim is a Korean-American poet. She was born in Seoul and grew up in California, and she earned a BA from Stanford, PhD from UC Berkeley, and an MFA from the Iowa Writers Workshop. And the first poem I'm going to read by Sandra Lim is titled Certainty. Perhaps you can tell children that the world is always a more beautiful place than you can suppose. And then you release them into their future, that black row of trees in the distance. She died suddenly in midwinter, in the same bed in which her husband died years earlier. It still sagged on his side. Her second husband remained in Japan with his first family. She used to say, "What my three girls do when they are on their own is unimaginable to me." My mother is the middle daughter, a garden of inaudible tunes. The four of them lived in a mean house in Seoul. One yellowing picture of my grandmother remains, and her face turns away from the camera as the rabbit senses the hound. She was said to be a solitary eater, an inner thing. What did she promise the world that she wasn't able to make good on? A child who abruptly feels the frontiers of experience assert themselves in her. At the funeral, my mother cries so hard she can't feel her hands for days. It explains how she scratches herself raw, meaningless. You have always believed these are your themes, fate, the negative pleasures of dipping oneself in acid. You think it will rescue you from your simplicity, remarks my mother from the doorway, but art is never the ace in the hole. I am not a stupid child. I am not even a child any longer, with her hesitant, then terrible certainty that loss is not only tragic but pointless. When she is lonely, my mother cooks, and when she is happy, she knows to hide it. And the second poem by Sandra Lim that I'm going to read is titled Pantoum, and it is a pantoum. Taking on an aspect of the Orient, skies full of hatchets and oranges. Love uninvited hangs in the blood, but what is a kingdom to a dying emperor? Skies full of hatchets and oranges keep the birds singing, sorrows fresh. But what is a kingdom to a dying emperor as the nights grow steadily into mountains? Keep the birds singing, sorrows fresh, the princess braids these into a necklace. As the nights grow steadily into mountains, why even regrets recede unexpectedly? The princess braids these into a necklace, roads and rivers that lead away from the palace. Why even regrets recede unexpectedly in a solitude full of wars and songs? Roads and rivers that lead away from the palace never converge in that vast landscape. In a solitude full of wars and songs, the words remain light and fugitive. Never converge in that vast landscape in the way that stars keep their distance. The words remain light and fugitive in an anticipation crossed with absence. In the way that stars keep their distance, love uninvited hangs in the blood. In an anticipation crossed with absence, taking on an aspect of the Orient. That's Sandra Lim. And now I'm going to introduce my guest for today, poet dramatist Cindy Williams Gutierrez. She is inspired by the silent and silenced voices of history and herstory, and her latest collection, Inlay with Nacre, The Names of Forgotten Women, was awarded the Willow Books Editor's Choice Poetry Selection and the Oregon Literary Fellowship for Writers of Color. Her debut collection, The Small Claim of Bones from Bilingual Press, placed second in the International Latino Book Awards and also caused her to be selected by Poet and Writers magazine as a notable debut poet. Cindy's poems have appeared in too many journals to mention. I'll just list a few. Our Own Calyx, Crab Orchard Review, Portland Review, Journal of Feminist Studies and Religion, and Ziziva. I love that name, Ziziva. Also, she's been anthologized in a volume titled Basta, 100 Plus Latinas Against Gender Violence, and also Raising Lily Ledbetter, Women Poets Occupy the Workspace. Cindy has performed her poems at the AWP conference in Chicago, as well as libraries, colleges, and museums throughout the Northwest through a variety of county and community programs. Her poems have also been exhibited in several art galleries, including the Newport Visual Arts Center and the Tillamook Forest Center, both here on the Oregon coast. Her award-winning play Words That Burn, played at the Milagro Theater, was recorded for the Literary Arts Archive Project and has also been produced in Klamath Falls and Twisp, Washington. And her play A Dialogue of Flower and Song was featured in the GAMELA, Spanish and Latin American Women's Studies Conference, co-sponsored by University of Portland and Portland State University. And she's a recipient of the Oregon Book Award for Drama for probably one of those things, but I'm not sure which. She's also taught creative writing to both youth and adults through a variety of programs, including Writers in the Schools, the Attic Institute, the Oregon Council for Teachers of English, the Oregon Poetry Association. I'm skipping over a lot of stuff here. This is one of the longer bios I've ever seen. Cindy is an extremely accomplished poet and dramatist, and I cannot wait to hear her read. So I'm going to stop there.
Thank you. So I will be reading from my forthcoming collection, which will be released on April 1st from Willow Books. And as you mentioned, Teal, it's called Inlay with Nacre, The Names of Forgotten Women. So I thought I would begin with Song for Nacre. O lustrous iridescence, slick with pink, silver, violet. You are the protector of flesh, lining abalone, coating oyster. Your sticky sheath rains gems. You glisten on the hilts of knives, in dewdrop buttons, boxes inlaid. Your beauty refutes age, while ours fades in fugitive images of sepia, platinum, mercury, and silver. Milky mother of pearl, we rub your sheen until our scaly skin gleams. My book is dedicated to the memory of my mother. So I thought that I would read this poem, which appears as the penultimate poem in the manuscript. Willow. The willow's green cauldron calls to me. It's 40 years since I climbed the old ash, my childhood sentinel. Last time I saw its canopy reach for the curb, new plumes of sky sifted through the heavy branches. I sat across the street in a red rental, pardoning the four cars in the driveway for their unfamiliar, colorless bodies. 2 hours before, my mother died at 3:24. The same smudged number on the wooden mailbox with the flag down. This was the last day I would see all my safe places. I didn't dare knock on the front door or toll the bell next to the back door in the carport. But if I had, I'd have clanged twice and then run to climb the ash to unbury my sorrow, to imagine poems or gaze through this painless window into neighbors' lives. Nothing stirred but the bird flapping in my chest. Here in my meadow, 2,000 miles northwest, the willow drapes at my feet. I reach up, climb in. The manuscript is divided into two sections, a section on wives and concubines and brides, and a section on mothers and daughters. And I'll read a few poems from the section on mothers first. Message from the Black Madonna to the first mothers. Some say I turned black from decay of gold and azure pigments leaking lead. Others credit centuries of grime, of devotees' votive candle smoke. I say, indigene, I belong to your kind. I am Our Lady of Africa in Algiers, Manila's Nuestra Señora de Guía, La Guadalupana in Mexico City. I am the brown, the black of the earth. I am the first to give birth, to nurse. My skin is the primordial soil. I open my dark palms to feed your kin. I place one word on your native tongue. Say, Malud, Napakanak, Nasser. From Africa to Mexico, you are first born. Born beyond nations, born to the land. And this poem is called Eugenics Rant, because it is a rant. A feeble-minded taxonomy for females in the early 20th century spelled compulsory sterility. And for Native American women in the 60s, feeble equaled unmarried pregnancy, or a white coat's verdict of promiscuity. And for 60% of Black women in Sunflower County, victims of Mississippi appendectomies, and one-third of Puerto Ricanas in our pulsing territory of bomba dances, due to their hyperfertility and their booming poverty, the U.S. polity decreed these ladies of the South and Commonwealth fail to see their burden on society's health and must tender their tubes or wombs as the toll, as the means to minority birth control. But if they were to rise to a higher station, and if they had a voice in this chosen nation, they would certainly vote for sterilization. This next poem is about the Magdalene laundries in Ireland. And it is called Mary Magdalene's Canticle. The epigraph is from Te Deum, a prayer in the Liturgy of the Hours, which is still prayed by monks and nuns in monasteries and convents. This is the epigraph. When thou tookest upon thee to deliver man, thou didst not abhor the virgin's womb. Let us praise the exhumed wombs, this closed pit of pelvic bones, from the silenced choir of corpses, this Irish mass of the nameless. Let us perfume their remains from my alabaster jars, anoint each skull with oil of myrrh, bless each pelvis with rose hips. From Matins to Compline, let us pray. Hallowed be their resting place, this glass Nevin grave. Let us chant for prostitutes. Rise up for fallen women. Join hands for unwed mothers. Claim and name their orphan children. Let us magnify their sins. Beauty, a treacherous siren. Virginity, a starved beggar. Poverty, a petty thief. From Matins to Compline, let us pray. Hallowed be the mound of this penitent's grave. Let us forget the chafed hands, lashes of leather by mother, razor-scraped scalps and shaved heads, but not the private meetings with father. Let us forgive the convent, Our Lady of Charity, for profiting from Magdalene laundries, for scouring the streets for slave labor. From Matins to Compline, let us pray. Hallowed be the laundresses in a white-washed grave. Let us build altars of barbed wire and milk leaking from swollen breasts, rip open adoption records, fill arms emptied of infants. Let us remember cremation, then reburial by the sisters, the land developer who unearthed remains in the first chaste grave. From Matins to Compline, let us pray for the 155 found in a Dublin convent grave. Your face mirrors mine before you were sown, child of Rwanda, child born of rape. And on days I know you are mine alone. My body, the consolation prize, my holes, the spoils of war. My name is gynocide. And on days I know you are mine alone, child of Rwanda, child born of rape. Your face mirrors mine before you were sown. My body, the consolation prize, my holes, the spoils of war. My name is gynocide. Until 1991, honor killings were legal in Brazil. Honor killings were killings in which men could legally kill their wives for infidelity. This is called In Brazil's Defense. And here is the epigraph. In this kind of crime, what is defended is not honor, but vanity. And the pride of the Lord, who sees a woman as his personal property. Brazilian Supreme Court Decision, 1991. Before, in defense of honor. Husbands, red-eyed lovers, killed with impunity. Lawyers won acquittals, homicide, legally. Women's bodies murdered for cuckoldry. After, in defense of economics. Men, Brazil's wild heartland, refused to abide. Expensive to divorce, cheaper save face, hire a gunslinger, kill your wife. And this next poem is about sati, the Hindu custom of a widow's self-immolation on her husband's funeral pyre. It was outlawed by the British in 1861, and this poem is based on an incident in 1987. Widow's choice. Roop Kanwar glowed in a billowing sari of flames. This newlywed, widowed at 18, childless. Did the 45 acquitted force her on the pyre? Or did she tempt the fire that left her lifeless? Thousands watched this Rajput woman turn to ash and bone. The alchemy of sati rendered her chaste. Pious flesh burned to arrest the remorseless cycle. Better her husband's safe passage than disgrace. Before the pyre, she apprehended a new sentence. She could flee and embody austerity. Shave her head, eat boiled rice, sleep on coarse matting, face down, or on the river in a rippling sari. And this is the last poem in the manuscript. It's called Dream Diary, Invocation. The moon's unblinking eye slices the dark. A windless night, and the aspens stand mute. In this circle of trees, I throw up my hands, rending the thick air. Rising and bowing again and again, my splayed fingers claw the emptiness, pregnant with everything lost, with the bound feet of unwanted girls, the kidnapping of school girls, trafficking of child girls, torture of activist girls, beating of wife girls, the molesting of small boned girls. A low, gurgling croak. She is here. I want to quiet the shrill, but there are too many predators, too many nests disturbed. I scan the trees for wings to shroud darkness, render it invisible. I can only rasp, Raven Woman, call to me with light. The darkness lurches. She tips one wing at the sky, the other at the grove. These aspens, now a radiant silver beneath the new moon. And her gurgling turns to grating. Stand tall among the upright people. The air quakes as her wings breathe the trees like lungs. In her wake, a murmuring stir like aspen, make a rush of sound that shakes the world.
Thank you. So many poets of my acquaintance over the last few years have sort of been struggling with wanting to address many of the things that you address in your poems and sort of struggling with how do we just rant about it? What do we do? How do we express these things but remain sort of true to our craft, true to the art of poetry? Where would you start with that? What tips would you give to someone who's sort of hung up on that rock?
Oh, gosh. I think there's so many different ways to create, to make poems. You know, I don't think poems are written. I think they're made. And we have so many different ways to shape them. We have so many different musical devices. We have so many different ways to be painterly on the page. And so I think that one of the big questions is, how do I enter this poem? Or how do I, you know, how do I birth this poem into the world? Because there's so many different ways to do that. And I really think that finding the form is one of the most important things. And for some of these poems, I didn't mention, but for example, Widow's Choice, which is about sati, a Hindu custom. I actually researched a form in which I had never written, which is called a doha, and it is an Hindi form that has 24 syllables, 13, and then the sejura, and then 11. And I think they're rhymed couplets, if I remember correctly. And so in some of these poems, I do research new forms that are specific to that culture as a way to be true to the poem and as a way to honor the culture, right? A way to be true. To be true. So that's one thing that I did that felt right to me. And then I think the other is to experiment. You know, I remember David Beispiel saying at the Attic that visual artists do hundreds of sketches sometimes, right? And as poets, sometimes we think we just have to go with a poem based on how it has started on that page. But that's not the case at all. I mean, you can start a poem and try different sketches of that poem, 5, 10, 20 of them, until you find the one that feels the truest.
So that's probably a good lead in to sort of writing practice questions. Do you have a writing routine? Do you write every day? Do you write as and when you can?
Yes. I would say not every day, but I really do enjoy being part of writing groups, and that gives me something, you know, a deadline of sorts, right? And when I know that I'm meeting with my group, I want to make sure that I bring something to the group. I also think that there's a rhythm. You know, I've been working on editing this book, and so that's a different type of activity involved with being a writer. And it's not that easy to be writing new poems while you're doing that very focused editing. Not that I'm not writing any at all, but I feel, I suppose I tell myself that, well, right now, this is about getting the book out, right? And then I think being a playwright, oftentimes I'm also working on plays and not only creating them, but getting them on their feet, right? And so that's a different activity that I do as a writer. And so I kind of look at more of a whole year or seasons, you know, that this is what I'm doing this season and it's not going to be necessarily what I'm doing the next season.
So with your plays, you've been actively involved in the production. You don't just hand the script over to someone and they walk away with it.
No, I've been fortunate because actually there's nothing for me more rewarding than being part of the rehearsal process. And so I've worked with directors who have allowed me to be part of that. And I'm able to also, when it's a new work, I mean, I'm able to revise it, even if it's slight, you know, slight modifications, it makes a difference. And I can't really do that unless I'm there witnessing mm-hmm. that process. So, yes, I was involved with Words That Burn when Gemma directed that. And I'm directing a staged reading of my new play, actually up in Twisp, Washington right now. So I'm involved as, you know, a playwright who is revising and director and probably co-producer.
So I'm now going to ask a very parochial question, which is, where is Twisp?
Oh, Twisp is in the Mattel Valley in Washington. It's near the North Cascades. It's right in north central Washington and 90 miles from the Canadian border as the crow flies. So you head down the gorge to exit 104 and go up 97 okay. and then eventually hit 153. But, you know, it's actually very important in terms of poetry because William Stafford has 7 poems that are inscribed on plaques around that valley. So
among the many things that I neglected to read from your fabulous bio, you're involved with at least 2 Latino writers groups, artist groups, and I'd like you to tell us a little bit about each of those.
Los Porteños is one of them, Portland's Latino Writers Collective, and let's see, it's been around, I think this would be our 13th year, and I'm very proud to be a co-founder along with Olga Sanchez, Emma Oliver, and Joanne Farias. We have about 15 members, and it is a multi-genre group, multilingual group, which I find very exciting. And we all share a common heritage or some kind of affinity for that heritage. And our signature event has been the Day of the Dead, Dia de los Muertos reading at Milagro every year. And that's where we started, was at Milagro. That's our artistic home. And we were doing some Stafford birthday readings for a while also, beginning in 2011. And then we've done a variety of things. Actually, Los Porteños produce Words That Burn. So that is something for which I'm very grateful. That was quite an undertaking for a writer's collective.
And the other?
Oh, are you thinking? Oh, the other one is the Salon. Okay, El Grupo de 08, which is a group of 08. Yes, so that is a Northwest Collaborative Artist Salon. In fact, we're having a salon tomorrow, tomorrow being March 10th. And I started that in June of 2008. That's why it's called the Group of 08. And it's named after Lorca's La Generación de 27, the generation of 27. It wasn't just Lorca, but Lorca was one of the members of that group. And so we feature multidisciplinary collaborations for about 5 hours on a Sunday afternoon, twice a year. And I invite literary artists, visual artists, and performing artists. So that's, you know, dancers, actors, musicians, sculptors, photographers, all kinds of people from across the Northwest. So we've had people all the way from Bellingham down to Eugene and across to Bend and White Salmon. And Twisp, actually. We have somebody coming from Twisp tomorrow. So in addition to multidisciplinary collaborations, we also feature cross-genre collaborations in the sense that if there is an artist, a single artist, who is working in more than one art form, I also invite people to present those kinds of works. And we eat 3 times. So it's a communal feast. And the folks who have supported me through all of this are my husband, Michael Kirshner, photographer Russell Young, who hosts the salon in the winter. We've hosted at my house in the summer. And then also poet and translator Greg Simon, who always does the invocation.
So I know Milagro Theater is kind of nationally recognized as a leader in the Latino literary arts community. Do you feel like Portland is kind of a center for that, or are there other stronger centers elsewhere in the country?
Oh, my goodness. I don't know if I can speak to that. I certainly think that Milagro is a milagro. It's really quite remarkable. I mean, they're going on almost 35 years, and it's just amazing what they have done, and the artistic home that they have provided for Latino artists. And, you know, it's not only theater. I mean, they've had all kinds of cultural events and other performing arts events and educational events, and they have the touring company, and they work with colleges and other educational institutions, and it really is a real gift that Milagro exists in our community and is recognized certainly throughout the whole Northwest and around the country. You know, where I come from in South Texas, I mean, certainly there's all kinds of organizations in the whole Southwest, and certainly in California, of which I'm aware, and I'm sure there are in other parts of the country as well. But I don't know that I can speak to, you know, specifics around that. I'm just very excited about what Jose and Danielle and Olga Sanchez, when she was there, have actually contributed to our community.
So now I think you said you were going to read a monologue from your new play. This is from your new play, right?
Yes. So the poems in the manuscript started speaking to me at night and telling me that
they can be so uncooperative. Yeah. Wake up. Work on me.
Well, that there was something else, really, is what they were saying, is that I think that there's a dramatic work here. And so maybe you're familiar with Entezake Shange's work, for colored girls who considered suicide when the rainbow was enough. We lost her, you know, recently. And that is one of the most performed plays ever. And I can't say that I was thinking about that, but this work that I've created is very much akin to that. She called that work a choreal poem. And I think I would call my work something very, very similar, because it is a play in verse, and it is very ceremonial, and it does have music and dance as well. And so what occurred to me was that I could have a play with women from different parts of the world, like European woman and African woman and woman of the Indian subcontinent and woman of the Americas. You get that idea. And that would be an ensemble of these women who would be performing these poems and providing commentary. And I also thought I needed a narrator. And the narrator only has one poem in the manuscript, but she has a lot of monologues in the play. And she's the only historical character. Her name is Enheduanna. Enheduanna was a Sumerian high priestess and the first known author of the world. The first author to actually sign her poems and to even invoke her own name in her poems. I, Enheduanna. So I became pretty intrigued with her. So she brings these contemporary women back to tell their stories. And she provides the glue with her monologues. And this is her final monologue. It's the epilogue. And this is what she says. I have traveled 43 centuries to return to you, your women. And I wonder about mine. You call them Iraqi Iranian, Arab, Syrian, Shia, Sunni, jihadist, terrorist. Many cloak their bodies. Too many take refuge in bordering lands, taking only what they can carry. All are daughters, most are wives and mothers with children to raise. Tell me, when you see the coal-lined eyes of my Muslim sisters, do you see me, the first author of the world, the high priestess to the goddess? Do you see the beginning of civilization cradled between the Tigris and Euphrates? The intricacy of henna painted on their hands, of mosaic and calligraphy in their mosques? What do we do when we are blind to beauty? What do we do when we forget? I was forgotten for centuries. My beautiful face was dust.
Wow. So I'm interested in the contrast between both this play and the poems you read from your new collection and versus your book, The Small Claim of Bones, which mm-hmm. seemed like it had a much smaller focus, and these more recent works seem really kind of global.
Mm-hmm. Yes.
What can you say about that?
I believe that, when I went back to school, I gave myself a birthday gift 2 years before I turned 50, which was to go back and get my MFA. So I graduated 2 months before my 50th birthday. And one of the most challenging things, and actually one of the most meaningful things as part of that process, was writing about my own work. It's not mm-hmm. something we normally do, and it's challenging to do. And it was very, very helpful because I realized then I had two primary lenses for my work. And one is a cultural lens and one is a feminist lens. And I feel that my two books manifest that. And that is actually very personally satisfying. Mm-hmm. So I believe that the second book is much more global and actually it spans much greater period of time because it is about woman. Right. And the first one is more of cultural allegory of my own identity. So it's this juxtaposition of my identity and my father growing up in Mexico, right, and my mother actually being Mexican-American but growing up here, and juxtaposing that with Mexico's history mm-hmm. of its indigenous history and its colonial history, right? So that's how I would explain that.
And sort of, I think that's reflected in the fact that Small Claim of Bones, there's quite a few Nahuatl words mm-hmm. and phrases and also some Spanish ones.
Right.
In the poems. And how do you approach that knowing that some of your readers aren't going to be familiar with these words? I saw there was a glossary in the back.
Yes, yes.
What other, I'm going to assume that you don't really think about that while you're writing, but at some point in the production, there must be some question of like, what are we going to do with these words? Are we just going to mm-hmm. accept that people don't know them, or how are we going to provide?
Uh-huh. An entry point. Yes, it's interesting because one of the discussions I had with my editor at Bilingual Press, which is part of Arizona State University, is do we italicize or not? Because there's a lot of them, mm-hmm. right? Mm-hmm. And actually, she and or the committee there made the decision, we are not going to italicize. the Spanish and the Nahuatl. Unless, in the case of Spanish, like the word mate is in there, you know, the tea, right? Mm-hmm. In the South American tea. It looks like mate, right? So if it looks just like an English word, then we will italicize it. So it's very, that was an interesting process to come to that. And they did decide also to italicize the Nahuatl when it was in the titles, mm-hmm. but only then. So you're right, there is a glossary. And then, I mean, I feel that these are the most emotionally evocative words. And I feel that they are in context. You know, they don't come from left field. And if you think about the Nahuatl words, many of them are the names of flowers and birds. That is so deliberate because the Nahuas, the seven tribes in the Central Valley of Mexico, and the Aztecs, you know, were the ruling tribe. They were called then as the Mexica. The Nahuas referred to poetry as flower and song.
Ah.
So the flowers and the songs, the birds, are in Nahuatl. And Nahuatl means clear speech. That is the meaning of their own language. So, so there's a little secret behind that, too. And I also, you know, I really believe in spoken word or the oral tradition, in word on breath. And so I perform, I think, you know, a lot of these poems right. with Gerardo Calderón. And I think that, you know, when you hear them, That also adds context because you're listening to the instruments, right? And we're inviting you into this world 600 years ago, thousands of miles from here. And it's a very different experience, I think, even than experiencing it on the page.
So he uses traditional instruments.
Yes. Yes, he uses Aztec instruments that either he's made or that he has purchased. And they are water drums and clay flutes and wind whistles and jaguar whistles and rain sticks. And, you know, it takes him half an hour to set up. And so all of these sounds mimic the natural world. And we always start with just him and the music and then add the words.
How did you come to start writing poetry? How old were you?
7. And I've never stopped. I was a shy child, and the page really was my confidant, my best friend. So it really was something very, very personal. And I loved language. I think also I went to a Catholic school for 13 years, and some of the first poems I wrote were actually in response to catechism homework. I thought it was a little bit boring just to kind of regurgitate, you know, what we had heard in class. So I would write the homework in verse. But it really was a way to express myself and to make sense of the world. Mm-hmm. Yeah. And it was a safe place to go.
So you were in Catholic school for quite a long time. Has that been sort of a lasting influence on your poetry or your way of thought?
Definitely religious study has been. I would consider myself a seeker. And so I'm very, very drawn to how we as humans relate to the divine, whatever that might be. And I have studied armchair study of mm-hmm. different religions, some more than others. I mean, to be able to write these Nahua poems in English, I had to immerse myself in the cosmology, not just the culture, but, you know, the whole world view. Yes, definitely. And I think also ritual, you know, Catholicism is steeped in ritual. And I definitely gravitate towards ritual, and it's still a part of my life. I would say I create more of my own rituals now, and I've written poems that are rituals, you know, ritualistic, right?
So one completely random question. What is one food you've always wanted to try, and why?
Oh, my gosh! That is that's the hardest question of all. I don't know. Oh my goodness. Are you a cook?
No, not really.
Okay. Oh my goodness. I watch, you know, I actually watch a lot of food shows. So I would love to just be, you know, I watched Chef's Table. I've watched it from the beginning. And there's an Argentine chef who just cooks out in the wild. I mean, he's a French trained chef. But of course, you know how we always go back to our roots, and he realized that's not what he wanted to do. So he just has these racks of meat on these open fires, and you know, I thought I would love to, and you have to take a boat, you know, to even get there. So it's and before the boat you have to travel, you know, 6 hours on this dirt road or something. I would love to go on a pilgrimage to a place like that just to experience the food from that place, you know, that's as true to that place as possible. I would love that, where it's not just about them. It's the whole experience, including getting there. Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Well, Cindy, thank you for joining us today. I believe that's a wrap.